Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 22, delivered on November 8, 2018. The title of this lecture is Component Costs of Capital.
Tonight, Component Costs of Capital. Before I begin that, we'll have a quick look at the stock market. Notice something interesting about today. As you go, the Dow was just up a tiny bit. But as you move from there, the Standard & Poor's was down 0.25%. And then the S&P was down a little more than 0.5%. So clearly, as the risk of the portfolio was going up, the damage was getting worse on it. Go.
So my small question, is it still a good day if everything's up and everything dips below for the majority of the day and it's just the bargain buyers manage to get up?
Oh, excellent question. In other words, if you have a down day, but all of a sudden at the end there's a rally, or the opposite, there's an up day and at the end there's the bears come in and slap things around, probably you're going to say if it was a down day and then there was a rally at the end, it's still probably a down day. That was the bargain hunters. The bears had gone home for the day, and so the bulls looked around, okay, bargains, grab some. Probably it's still going to, you would call that on the downside for the day. In this case, clearly, even at the best, the Dow, the big stable companies, there wasn't really a lot of motivation to protect stock prices there. And as you get to the NASDAQ, it was down. Now, they're claiming that the Fed was the cause of the down day. Probably that's a little bit too much. I did want to show you something. It's probably the news has changed since the last time, so I probably won't find it. Now, interestingly enough, just a quick thing, looking at markets, Home Depot is now on watch lists of a number of analysts. Home Depot, actually, the reason Home Depot is interesting is because of one of its competitors who's been having problems that were a little more significant than we thought they were. Does anyone know who the main competitor of Home Depot is? Yeah? No? Lowe's. Lowe's, and Lowe's has recently announced that it is going to start closing some of its stores. The one here in town will stay open, but two more in the state are going to be shut down. So as Lowe's is beginning to contract, that puts more interest on its competitor, Home Depot. And so that one comes into the news. In other words, if you're a sector buyer of stocks, in other words, I want to buy stocks in the retail home improvements market, and one of the love children of that market, Lowe's, starts showing signs that it's not doing so well, you're probably not going to go away from being a sector buyer. You're going to look for a new target for your investments. That's why Home Depot would be of interest. But now we're very interested in seeing, is Home Depot going to come through with good, strong earnings for this one? I wanted to find one. It looks like it's out of the news cycle right now. Huh? Don't know anything about her. The Tesla, its largest quarterly profit in the company's history in the third quarter, $6.8 billion in revenue. Interesting. Oh, she was a board member. CFO, too. So, yeah, she's an insider. I didn't think he was going to bring. They were going to bring in anyone from the outside on this. I give. There was one here that I wanted to show you, and it's now disappeared from the news cycle, so I won't even bother to talk about it. Nope. It's gone. So anyway, right now, another thing that I do want to show you, it's a Treasury yield curve for the day. Right here, and we'll look at the current month. Go. As I had said, the original interest was in the 7-10 year. But now it's getting more to the point where we are keeping our eye on the 3-5 year. You notice that it is a 4 basis point spread. And you might say, well, it was a 4 basis point spread, 3.03 to 3.07, 4 basis point yesterday, 3.05 to 3.09, 4 basis point spread today. So the first reaction would be, well, the basis point spread has not changed. Actually, yes, it has. Because 4 basis point spread on 3.03 is more than a 4 basis point spread on 3.05. Again, even though the absolute number, 4 basis points, has stayed the same, it's 4 basis points on a higher starting point. So 4 basis points off 3.03 is more than 4 basis points off 3.05. So actually, the yield curve is flattening out. Percentage-wise, we are getting closer to the inversion. Now, in terms of absolute basis points, we're still a few days away. I would say that probably not until sometime next week, late in the week, will we see the inversion. It's possible it could be even longer than that. But I am figuring that probably sometime on Thursday or Friday, we'll see our inversion. Go.
Is there any significance if it flips at the 3-5 as opposed to the 7-10?
Historically, a shorter end flip will probably signal a stronger recession, simply because most companies, and you're going to run into this, when you get into corporate America, you will be assigned to one of the budget teams. It's a very common thing. There are different budget cycles. There is a very short-term budget cycle, and there's a team that works on the numbers to project the money needs for the short term. Then there's a budget team that works on the 1 to 2 year cycle, taking the numbers from the short term team and then fashioning the financials over the 1 to 2 year budget cycle. There was a brief mention of this early in the textbook. Now, the strategic team is 3-5 projecting out in most companies, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But 3-5 is considered long. Crafting what our projects and our budget needs for money are going to be over the 3-5 year period. That's the long team. Now, when you're talking about a long team that's looking 3-5, that's in the range of the 3-5 year yield curve. So in other words, that when that thing inverts, that is more significant in terms of a typical company's planning horizon on the long term. So that's why you would say that if that thing inverts in that region, then companies are going to really shut down their planning over the long haul, which they would consider the 3-5 years. Now, there was an arcane thing that you guys learned, and I hope you learned in your economics classes. You didn't have the greatest economics class, I'm sure, because I wasn't your teacher. But in your economics class, do you remember how they talked about perfect competition, and then they talked about monopolistic competition, and then oligopoly, and then monopoly? Okay. The biggest companies on earth are oligopolies. Now, oligopoly is very, very different from monopolistic competition. Standard & Poor's 500 companies, those are monopolistic competitors. They're monopolistic in the short run, competitive in the long run. It's just how it works. Oligopolies function in a very different way. Their strategic plans are over periods of 20, 50, 100 years. They don't plan the way that companies that you and I mostly think about plan. So, for example, an Intel is at any given point probably developing three or four generations of microprocessor chips. At this point, they are actually developing quantum chips. They're in the early stages. They're already well into developing the 3D chips that are going to power things that are quite awesome in the next few years. You don't know that's happening, but it is actually happening. Oil companies, they really don't give a rat's ass about this year's or next year's oil revenue. They're planning over horizons of 20, 50, 100 years. So if you're one of those people who says, well, peak oil, we're going to run out of oil. Oh, God, the world will come to an end. No, it's covered. Those oil companies know exactly what's going on. They're not stupid. They are strategic players. They don't see their competitors as competitors. They see themselves on a chessboard that is spanning out through the world and now well beyond the world into other places, the orbital around the Earth, the Moon, interplanetary. They're now, some of them are looking at the asteroids, trying to figure out how we can start extracting from some of those asteroids that have unbelievable resources. So they're planning out way out there. They're not worried about what's happening right now. As far as peak oil goes, they're not going to leave this century with no oil. They'll make sure that they have the next generations covered, and they'll control the resources. They'll control the energy production mechanisms at the end of the century. They're not going to give up and let someone else, some piss-ass companies that build wind turbines, take over energy production. They're not stupid. So strategic planners are very different companies, and they're a completely different kind of economics, and also actually a different kind of finance, too, than companies that I teach you about. Anyway, enough of that. Let me show you. I want to keep that in mind up there. Now, remember, when I talk about the component costs of capital, it's just arithmetic for the most part. Just know the formula, apply the formula. Monkey see, monkey do. Now, on the debt side, remember that I told you that, first of all, the after-tax cost of debt is what we care about because companies deduct their interest expense. So whatever your cost of debt is, you multiply it by 1 minus the company's marginal tax rate to get the after-tax cost of debt. And the other thing is that don't use the coupon rate. A company is selling its most recent debt has a coupon of 5%. That's not what you would use for the R sub D. You would look at the yield to maturity on it. Now, most services are going to give it to you, but I did remember I showed you how to get the YTM, the I percent on your TI-83 calculator. And so you'll do that. There's a problem in the homework where you actually do that trick. It says, well, the price of the debt is, the coupon is, and the term to maturity is. So all you do is you just back into the yield to maturity on the debt. That's all you do. So remember to use the yield to maturity. In other words, what the market says the debt should pay now for that. Now, as far as equity goes, remember the different flavors of equity. There's the internally generated equity. Now, the book uses the term retained earnings for this. Okay? That's really not a good thing because there really isn't such a thing as retained earnings, but it's a quick way to talk about. And yes, when a company earns money, it's paid its bills and the money at the bottom line is belongs to the shareholders. That is a cost to the company. In other words, in accounting, profit is a good thing all over. But in finance, yeah, it's great, but that equity has a cost to the shareholders. Look, remember the retained earnings beginning plus net income minus dividends is your retained earnings at the end. And then you add that to your paid in capital. In other words, what the shareholders originally paid for their stock, and that gives you your total shareholders' equity. This is a book value, of course. The market value is really what's important. But what I'm trying to bring up here, though, is the issue that the company, those retained earnings are a cost. They are actually a cost to the company. Think about it this way. Do this. Sir, do you own a car?
Yeah.
Good. Is it paid off?
Yeah.
Okay. That car is a cost to you. You own it, but it's a cost to you. I'm not talking about the gasoline. I'm not talking about the insurance. The car itself is a cost to you because you could sell that car and have scratch. Well, I couldn't do that because I wouldn't have a car. Well, that doesn't matter. You still have a cost, an opportunity cost of that car, keeping it. And that's the reality of what we see in finance is that there is no free capital. It's all got a cost. Debt capital, equity capital, it all has some cost to you. Now, the cost of internally generated equity, the classic way, and the book gives you this formula too, is R, and I'm going to write R sub S. R sub S, the cost of stock, of common stock, is the dividend one period out over the current price of the stock plus the growth rate of the dividends. Now, you've got a couple of cautions here, and I said this before. When you do this problem, these problems are really easy. Just make sure that you know whether they're giving you the dividend this period, which means you'd have to grow it one period, or the next period's dividend in which you already have the D1. So in other words, if they say the company will pay a dividend next year of $1.25, that's the number you put in there. But if they say the company paid a dividend of $2 this year and it's going to grow by 5%, then you would take the $2 and grow it one period at 5%. In other words, $2 times 1.05. Just make sure you use the right number for that. Now, a couple of things. This growth rate can actually be kind of a pain in the ass because there are a lot of companies that actually have tried to maintain a stable growth rate. Other companies, I showed you a problem. If you can't find the growth rate any other way, there's a really desperate approach. There's a problem in your problems about this. And just do it this way. Don't even ask why. You can estimate the growth. If you don't have any other way to estimate the growth, you can say 1 minus the dividend payout ratio times the return on equity. Now, 1 minus the dividend payout ratio is the plowback ratio. In other words, what percentage of the company's earnings did it keep and plow back into the company? Like if a company made $10 million and it paid $4 million in dividends, that would mean its plowback ratio was 60%. That's the number you'd use there, 1 minus the dividend payout ratio. Again, if you had, let's say, a company that had $50 million in earnings and it paid, let's say, $10 million in dividends, then what you'd have, that would be 10 over 50. That's a 20% dividend payout ratio, so 80% would be the plowback that you would use there. Now, why does this formula work? Don't even ask. Just do it. This is one of the things. Just do it. If there's no other way to get a growth rate to put into the formula, just do this for the growth rate. This is one way that you can calculate the discount rate, the cost of internally generated retained earnings capital. Another way that you could do it, of course, is the capital asset pricing model. You could also, this is way one, this is way two, the return on common stock would be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's another way you can do it. The CAPM is really a desirable way to do it. The problem can sometimes come in. Suppose I want the discount rate for something where you don't have a beta. Remember how we did the net present value of some projects, accept or reject? Well, what would be the beta of a project as opposed to the beta of a company? The way we usually do it is we look at a project and then we find companies that do only that kind of a project. In other words, we find comparables to the project. And then those companies' betas, we sort of take the average of them. Like, for example, suppose that you have a company that is saying, let's see if we can build electric cars. Well, that's a project in the company. So how do we analyze this project in terms of its risk and its required rate of return? Well, what we would do is we would look at companies that do only electric cars. Well, we can't find any of those. Okay, let's find companies that do only big electrical machinery, electricity-driven machinery. And then we use those as our comps. That's literally how we could analyze a company that is trying to decide whether it should start building electric cars or not, is by finding companies that are only electric machinery companies. It's a way. It's not great. A quick word about dividends here. Actually, kind of an extended word about dividends. When would a company pay dividends? One argument, this is the one that the book gives you. This is the easy argument. I would provide a dividend to my shareholders if I could not, as a company, find any way to invest that money to earn more than it cost to have that money in my retained earnings. Let me explain. About 40% of the money that I generated as a company, as net income this year, I've got projects that I could invest that in that are higher than the cost of that equity. Okay? But 60% of that money, I got no projects that I could really invest it in. So that would mean that I should probably give that 60% of my earnings back to my shareholders. Let them invest it. So in other words, suppose that my earnings were $10 million. Now, my cost of internally generated capital is 16.5%. Okay? I've got, let me do this one. I got $6 million in projects that will earn 17.0% to 20.8%. But the other $4 million I got projects that will earn anywhere from 2.0% up to 16.3%. In a case like this, it would be better if I just gave this $4 million back to my shareholders as dividends. Because I can't earn enough to justify it, the cost of that, of keeping that money in retained earnings. That's a logic for why a company would pay a dividend. There's a problem with this logic. Madam, I got $10 million. Are you going to give me back $4 million of that and say, well, I just can't earn anything on that? Are you going to do that? Oh, hell no. I'll find something. I'll call the damn Russians, you know, or the Chinese or someone like that. I'll find a way to earn money on it. That's the problem, is with claiming that a company, you have to be a really sucky company if you can't figure out a way to make a lot of money on money you make. I mean, that would worry me if you have a company that comes to your door and says, here's $4 million of what we made because we can't figure out anything to do with that money. Really? I want to talk to your CFO and his seeing eye dog to find out why they can't find any projects that earn a lot of money. That's a really lame excuse for giving dividends. Well, we just don't know, have anything we can do with that money. And yet, companies pay dividends. But that explanation really doesn't give us a good reason. And so I will explain to you briefly a concept that is being developed in business. And it's a huge concept, and it's been around for many years, but it's finally beginning to seep into business logic. It comes from, actually, electrical engineering and communication theory. It's called signaling theory. Signaling theory. I'm a very rich person, and you two are my favorite nieces. Okay? Weird couple of nieces, but, you know, can't figure out which one's David's which. But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a $1,000 check, each of you, every Christmas. Now, you see, I don't have to do that. I don't want you to like me. I mean, I'm old. I don't care. Even my cats, I have to hang a pork chop around my neck if I want them to like me. So, mind you, I'm just giving you this money. I'm not going to get anything back from it except maybe a huggy. But I can't even do that because then your dad thinks I'm weird, you know, things like that. You see, there's really not a reason other than that I'm signaling I can do this. I can. Years ago, I consulted. One of my consulting gigs was for one of the alphabet houses. Now, this was before your time. There were these huge insurance brokers. Now, a broker represents the buyer of a product. As opposed to insurance agents, which you know, they represent the sellers, the insurance companies. Insurance brokers work with huge corporations and set up packages of insurance to cover all of their different liability exposures. So, for example, a company like Wendy's International would go to an insurance broker and say, we've got all these different exposures. Can you go to all the different insurance companies, represent us, and put together a package of insurance to cover all of our different exposures? That's what insurance brokers do. Now, the alphabet houses were the big, huge brokers. And they were called alphabet houses because they had names like Alexander and Alexander, A&A, Johnson and Higgins, J&H, Marsh and McLuhan, M&M. So I was consulting for one of these alphabet houses. And this alphabet house had had a very, very strong year. And at Christmas season, I was invited to the Christmas party. It was a lavish affair. They had all these tables of food set up, caviar. They had these little lamb chops. I mean, I was stuffing lamb chops in all of my pockets to take home with me. And they had little cheeses and all the booze that you wanted. Some of it had weird French names, Chateau Neuf de Derrière and all that. But whatever. And I was, here comes the president and CEO, ting, 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 with his little wine glass, and he gets up there and he starts talking about what a great year it was and how we couldn't have done it without all of you in this room. It's just a wonderful, wonderful year. We have had the biggest profits ever, and we're growing by leaps and bounds. We now stand at the cusp of being the largest of the alphabet houses. And then he puts down his glass, and he pulls out this enormous cigar, you know, a cigar. It was a Havana, and he takes it, and he puts it in his mouth, and then with a match, he lights a $100 bill. And I thought, you're going there. I've never seen anyone actually light a cigar with $100. He was doing it. He lit that cigar with a $100 bill. And then once he got the cigar going, he tosses the $100 bill into an ashtray. Well, I'm like, anyway, you understand why he lit a cigar with a $100 bill. You do understand that, right? Because he could. That was a signal. That was a signal. Yeah. Signaling theory is the theory that actions by persons can be explained rationally only as signals of intention or wealth. Can only be explained rationally as intentions or wealth. In other words, I am signaling I can do this. So I give you that $1,000 check, I can do that. I walk up and there's this dog that lives next door. The dog has one of those invisible wire fences. So I walk up to the dog and say, hey, dog, your mama was a cat. Now, do I do that to hurt the dog's feelings? Yes, but I'm signaling the dog. I am Alpha Dog, and you have to take my abuse. Sooner or later, that dog's got to figure out how to get around that fence and go to bite me all. Anyway, look, signaling theory in dividends is that, no, it's not because of this explanation they give you in the book. It's because we are signaling the shareholders that we are well off enough that we can provide you with this dividend. That's why communication. You folks in marketing, I like to joke and kid you all the time, but when we talk about integrated communication, you guys are at the shock front of signaling we can do this in many different ways. And it is a way to demonstrate our ability that we can signal with real money our intentions. Sometimes, have you noticed that once in a while I'll extend a deadline on a homework or on an exam? Am I really a nice guy who really loves people? I want you all to love me and give me great ratings on ratemyprofessor.com. No. I do that because I am demonstrating to you that a professor can do that. Give and take.
Demonstrate wrong, I don't think I've really got the
More the signal hasn't quite come through at a high signal to noise ratio.
You should demonstrate that you're really good at teaching and just give all of us A's. Honestly, because you care. Because you care.
But then I wouldn't respect myself, and I look in the mirror and I think, do you respect yourself?
But think of the power moves, the administration. Self-respect is overrated anyway.
So true, so true. But they've got money. It doesn't matter. Okay, would you rather be a Kardashian or not?
Oh, God. Which one?
One. Are there any of them who actually wax? Anyway. Externally generated equity. All you do is, and I write this R sub N, new equity, is the dividend period one over the price now minus the float plus G. In other words, it's costlier because if your stock is selling at $50 a share, but you have to give the brokers who sell the stock your new equity $5, then you're really getting only $45 a share. And I showed you a problem like that in the last class. One thing I want to point out, though, notice something interesting about these formulas. Look at the internally generated equity one. It's very obvious there. Do you notice that as the price of a company stock goes down, the cost of equity goes up? Do you see that? As the price of the stock, P sub zero, the price right now, is a denominator. So when a stock price goes down, that is automatically, by definition, stating that the cost of equity capital is rising in that corporation. I had, more than a few clients. I would talk to them. We would have a board meeting. I'd say, look, the price of the stock is really taking a bath right now. Well, so what? We're not selling any stock right now, so who cares? And they didn't understand the implication is that as that stock price was falling, the cost of equity capital was rising. So the weighted average cost of capital was rising for the company. And because it is not happening, they don't feel it. They don't see it in the corporation's hustle and flow from day to day. They just dismissed what I was trying to explain to them. It's sort of like, I see you drinking booze. Yeah, you're 20, you can handle it. No, 21, I'm sorry, 21, yes.
Sure about that?
No, it's not for the hardcore stuff. Okay, I see you doing it at 30. Exactly, what is that? Are we talking like Chivas Regal or something?
Smell it?
Oh. That's water, man. What the hell? Anyway, but as time goes on, you don't see it in any given day from day to day, but ultimately, the erosion of your company because you are bearing too much cost does catch up over a long period of time. There are plenty of case studies where we look at companies that were not concerned about maintaining stock price. You know, they were doing okay, but they never advertised that they were doing okay. They never took those trips to New York City to talk to the Wall Street boys. They never made the effort to get the message out that the stock was worth buying. And so the stock price was below what its intrinsic value was for years and years. No one knew about the company. And what that did was, over a long period of time, these companies, even though they were good companies, they eventually died because they'd been spending too much money for so long because their cost of capital was too high. And all they needed to do was be more forthcoming and louder about what it was that made their company great. Yeah.
So, how do you fix your stock price
it's a balancing act. You try to find out why, first of all, why is the stock price falling? Sometimes it's easy. Okay, we suck. Other times it's not so easy. I've actually had companies that years ago, they said, look, our stock price is falling. And I said, well, so what? You're a bad company. And they said, no, we're not. And they, in one case, a company flew me out to San Diego. They showed me all their financials. Their company was freaking fine. It was speculative. Now, I didn't expect the stock price to be very high, but it was a strong company. It had a great couple of ideas. This was back in the early days. And I mean, give you an idea of what this company was into. And you'll say, well, I never saw that. That's right, because this company essentially held Loctite patents on the trick they were doing. This was in the early days of cable TV, where they were contracting with companies that were advertising on cable TV, and a little box on top would print out coupons for the companies that were advertising. And it was, you know, it was an idea. It was a good idea. Basically, it was fundamentally a strong idea, because essentially, without marketing too strongly, the cable TV didn't really have to do strong advertising, but when a company wanted to pay money, it could actually attract customers by just having a coupon slide out quietly, unobtrusively, for that company's product that just got advertised. And I thought, well, this is actually surprisingly interesting. And the company's stock price just sat there. I called a couple of people I knew not on Wall Street, but just off Wall Street. And I said, have you ever heard of this company? No. I said, well, let me tell you what they do. And they said, no, don't bother. If they have to hire you to do their marketing, then we're not interested in them. Well, I said, well, you know, kiss my butt. The company died. It just died because the stock price never got legs under it. And so the cost of equity capital was very high. The company didn't use much debt at all. So the weighted average cost of capital was terrible because most of that weighted cost was equity, which was very expensive because their stock price was so dang gone low. So there you go. It does have consequences. Ultimately, this company did need money. And when it went out there to try to sell new common stock, How are you going to possibly make it when your stock price is $1.50 and you have to raise $10 million? They would have to have sold more stock than the company had authorized. It was a mess from one end to the other, and the company died rather quietly. I didn't even hear exactly when. I just found out later.
Why did they think to do a sexy car wash to raise money?
A car wash? I would have been okay with it. I would have even done the car wash with them if they'd given me some stock in their company.
So you want them to make no money?
I'll have you know. I will have you know. Back in that time. Okay, now preferred. This one's easy. Preferred stock, the cost of preferred stock is going to be the perpetual dividend over the current price of the stock, preferred stock. And remember, the dividend is nothing but it's stated. The dividend is this percent of the par value. Preferred stock, as I've said before, it's just not popular, and yet it is usually cheaper than common stock, quite a bit cheaper. It's more like the cost of debt. And even if you want to raise new money through preferred stock, as I told you in the last lecture, the float for preferred stock is very low. And the question just keeps persisting. Why don't more companies use preferred stock to raise money these days? It's just one of those things. It's just out of vogue. And although it's still popular with some kinds of companies, real estate companies still use preferred stock. And there are other companies that do too. But let me show you something here. When I refer to capital structure, I mean the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises capital structure. Now, I'm going to go to SEC.gov, go to company filing search, and I'm going to look up Netflix, NFLX. Now, for the purposes of what I'm going to do here, I'm going to look at the 10Q, which is the most recent snapshot of the corporation's financials. Financial statements, consolidated balance sheet. Okay. Now, what we're looking at here is book values, not market values. We're just looking at book values. But if we're looking at book values, the total assets of Netflix as at September 30 were $23.366 billion dollars. Of that, stockholders' equity was $5.010 billion, which would mean that the liabilities would be $16.957 billion. So the capital structure of Netflix as of September 30th, as of a little more than a month ago, percent debt would be 16.957 over 23.366, and the percent of equity would be 5.010 over 23.366. Calculator. So 16.957 divided by 23.366, 72.6% and 27.4%. That's the capital structure of Netflix. By almost any measure, this is a highly leveraged firm. What is a good debt equity? You can't say that. It depends upon the industry. Some industries are much more weighted toward equity. Some industries are weighted much more toward debt. But in this case, that is pretty impressive as far as their leverage goes. But what we can do here is we can say, okay, what is the actual impact of this? If I go over to the operations, their times interest earned for the most recent period is 480,668 divided by 108,382. No, 862. Can't read those numbers worth a darn. So they're about 4.4 times interest earned. In other words, they have enough money for about 4.5 times over to pay the interest that they owe. So they're not in danger, although that is getting a little bit short on it. They're really not in all that much danger yet. However, after they filed their 10Q, let's go back here. Did you notice that there was something listed after the 10Q? An 8K, which coincidentally was issued after they issued their financial statements on September 30th. Here's the 8K. Remember, the 8K is non-recurring events. Okay. Now, there is an effort, and it's been going on since I was the consultant, to get companies to write in plain language, not in fancy legalese. This is fancy legalese. On October 23, 2018, Netflix Incorporated, the company, entered into one, a purchase agreement, the dollar note purchase agreement, with Morgan Stanley and Company LLC as representative of several initial purchasers listed in Schedule 1 thereto, the dollar note initial purchasers, relating to the sale by the company of $800.0 million aggregate principal amount of its 6.375% senior notes due 2029, the dollar notes, and two, a purchase agreement, the euro note purchase agreement, and together with the dollar note purchase agreement, the purchase agreements with Morgan Stanley and Company International PLC as representative of several initial purchasers listed in Schedule 1 thereto, blah, blah, blah. What are they saying? Yeah? $800 million. And they did this after that financial. Is that to save stock? No. They just borrowed. They just love borrowing money. For what?
They have to create their own content in order to stay relevant. No
question about that. I want to see Walmart get into original content. The people of Walmart, you know, greeters of Walmart.
I guarantee you that their demographic would actually probably respond pretty well.
Are you kidding me? That would replace Duck Dynasty. What they did, 800 would add to that. So if everything else remained constant, our new debt would be 17.757 billion, and this would be 25.166 billion. So the new debt to equity ratio would be 17.757 over 25.166. Would it be 24? Add 8 billion to this. Yeah, that's right, 24. 24. Whew. Getting late. So now we are about 17.757 over 24.166 73.5. percent debt, and equity would be 26.5. The company is tilting even more heavily toward debt. $800 million. Interestingly, if you look at that agreement carefully, see that 6.375%? That is their cost of debt right now, times 1 minus T. If the debt sells at par, which it probably will. The next thing is, did you notice that there's more money there? I didn't even cover all of that money. Okay, they raised something else too. They raised $1.1 billion aggregate principal amount, but that $1.1 billion was in euros. Do you remember what those are called? When you denominate in a currency other than the currency of the country of origin? Panama denominated in American dollars. Netflix is denominating in euros. What do you call those kinds of debt instruments?
Foreign
paper. Those are foreign bonds. In other words, it looks as if they couldn't get all the money they wanted from American investors. So they went over to Europe.
Well, it's also likely that they just had a lot more European original content.
That would have nothing to do with where you get your money. Really?
But they probably wanted to pay the studios in Europe with euros. So they probably requested, actively sought money in euros, too, to pay for original content.
That could be the case, or they could be simply that they can't find American investors, because it's like a blink of an eye to turn an American dollar into a euro. Essentially what they're doing is they're going directly to Europe, seeking European money for operations that are going to be all over the world. Most of this money, they claim, is going to be to go into the subcontinent, the Asian subcontinent of India.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be raising in rupees then?
Yeah.
They're going after a strong currency. They're going after a currency that is not American. What they are doing is essentially they're balancing their debt portfolio between American obligations and European obligations. In other words, as other companies are doing, and you can see this around the United States now, a number of companies are quietly getting their money from other countries now that will provide the money in a currency that is useful. They'll get their money in American dollars from China. They'll get their money in euros from Russia or from Europe. They'll get their money in currencies like Saudi Arabia's. It's quietly beginning to happen all over the world that companies are now getting some money from American investors, but they are reaching out because they want to make sure that they have a foothold in the world of the 21st century. That will be a world where the United States will no longer be the dominant economic force of the Earth or the near space around the Earth. That's all I have for you tonight. Thank you.